The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bradick, and good day to all of you here and those of you attending with us online and on the phone. Last week, we had heard what I believe was a much-needed message regarding the Christian man. And in it, Mr. Bradick had explained that most men in our culture have truly lost their sense of their role in society and in the family. And there has been a feminization of men today, not simply in dress and in hairstyle, but also in function in many, many ways. And so many men we see have chosen to take a back seat and not only allow, but to encourage the woman to be the provider, the decision maker. And many men, as Mr. Bradick put, have simply wimped out and do not stand up and to protect the woman and their children. And so we saw that this preface is not limited to those who are married, but also includes even single men who are opting out, that is, refusing to take their rightful place as a productive part of society. And we also learned how this attitude has greatly affected the Church of God and how Christian men truly have a duty to be a man and to do what God has intended for each of us men to do within our families and within society. Now, because of the message we had heard, the question naturally arose in the Q&A period of our Sabbath observance. What is a Christian woman to do if her man refuses to live up to his responsibilities? How should she react to situations where the man is not being a man? What is a Christian woman's place? And do these principles set for her apply also to those who are not married, to single women? Well, I hope to answer some of these questions today to the best of my ability, given I am a male, but I do think I have a good understanding of what God expects of men and women in this regard. And so I think to begin with, we should first consider the ways of a Christian woman in general. And what better place to begin than in Proverbs in chapter 31, if you'd open up and go over there to Proverbs in chapter 31. This chapter begins with a woman writing to a king, or it could be that the king was simply recording the words that were given to him by his mother, as it says in verse 1. But we're going to pick it up in verse 10 here, where it states, "Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain." And of course he trusts her, because she's a God-fearing woman, and he has confidence in her, and she makes decisions that are in his best interest, as well as the interest of the entire family. And so she does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands, and so she's not afraid to get her hands dirty. She works hard, and she does what it takes to take care of her man and the family. She is like the merchant ships, and she brings her food from afar. And she also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and also a portion for her maidservants. And so she, again, does what is necessary to take care of people. And she'll get up early in the morning, sometimes before the sun even rises, to fix food and make sure that the family has the sustenance they need to make it through the day. In verse 16, she considers a field and buys it. From her profits, she plants a vineyard. And so she has a piece of property, and she has profit from this vineyard. Verse 17, she girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good, and her lamp does not go out by night. And so she's a hard worker. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hand holds the spindle. She extends her hand also to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. And so she is a charitable woman, showing kindness and love even to those people that are in need. She's not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. And so she prepares, right? She is prepared in advance. She's not afraid of the coming winter storm because she has made the garments necessary to keep her man and her children warm and protected from the cold. Verse 22, she makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. And so she decorates herself beautifully. Her husband is known in the gates, and when he sits amongst the elders of the land, he is known. And why? Because he has this virtuous woman, because he is a God-fearing man. He is honorable, and she is honorable, and people look to them with honor and respect. She makes linen garments, in verse 24, and sells them, and supplies sashes for the merchants. And so again, she has a little business here on the side where she makes things that are of quality, things that people desire, and she sells them to people in the town. Verse 25, strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness, because she is a God-fearing woman, and that's why she has this wisdom in her mouth and the tongue of kindness in her mouth. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and they call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her, and rightly he should. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing. But a woman who fears the Eternal, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. And we see how works such as these would praise her in the gates. She would have a good name in the community for being such a woman. And so these characteristics that we have read here in Proverbs 31, they were written many, many years ago, thousands of years ago. But they are characteristics that are timeless, aren't they? She is the woman that all women were meant to be. And so here is described the attributes of a female that is far more valuable than precious stones. You know, fine rubies are the most expensive of all the gems. And in fact, the world's largest ruby, amazingly enough, is 8.2 pounds. It's over 18,000 carats, and its value is estimated to be in the neighborhood of $6.3 billion. However, a virtuous woman is worth far more than even this. She is priceless. And so for generations, women generally understood these honorable principles that we have mentioned, and even the others that we will mention as the sermon goes forth. Even those women that were not learned in the scriptures were taught ethics that are described here, and to many women, these moral values were seen as they were to be, how they were to be in life. But what went wrong? Something went wrong. What has changed that has led many women to forsake these moral standards and to deny their God-given role in society and in the family? Let's turn over to Psalm in verse 113. Excuse me, Psalm chapter 113. In the late 1800s, the women's suffrage movement began, which aimed at extending voting privileges to all women. Now, after several years of protesting and campaigning, public opinion eventually changed and their wish was granted. However, what began at this time as an admirable cause did not end with the right to vote. After America became involved in World War II, approximately 16.5 million Americans were called to duty, and most of this number were men. Now, because of this, women were forced to take jobs in the community to supply the country with food and with the goods needed for war while their husbands went off and fought a terrible battle. This was a noble cause and an appropriate effort by the women at this time as they continued to support their families and the community by doing this. However, after victory was achieved, the men returned from war, but the women had a hard time going back to their natural roles in society. And it's because men also started seeing that there were monetary benefits in this, and that they could benefit from having a double income. And so they came to embrace women as a viable means of labor and revenue. Now, at this same time, there also began to be a rise in the cost of living. And so the wage needed to support a family was as such that many began to have a need for a double income to be comfortable and many times even just to get by. In addition, the feminist movement gained strength and influence, and some began to feel that men and women should be equal in every way possible. Same pay for same labor, which is right in and of itself, but many began to promote the idea that there was no such thing as a woman's quote-unquote natural role, and that she should be able to do anything that she desired. As time marched on, Satan continued to build the anti-family machine, and the feminist movement expanded, and their roles in the workforce began eventually to challenge jobs that were traditionally held by men. And we began to see that women would often work harder than men, and they were more consistent in accurately seeing jobs through from beginning to finish. And men then began to take a step back, and they allowed a feminization of their roles to take place. All in all, men allowed, and in fact they encouraged this to happen, and a woman's value in the workforce was established. Now, what began, as I said, as an admirable cause by women has now transformed into a society that cranks out values that are, in fact, anti-family, and they switch the roles of men and women. And this is a bold defiance against God's family structure. And so today we have people that have become ensnared by a supposed need for a double income. And this is because women commonly play the role as provider, and many men have moved to a point to where, you know, they see this as typical and as a standard, a staple in society today. And so, because women are so valuable in the workforce, many of them even make more money than the man. And it's come to the point where some men even desire their women to work so that they can take care of them, so that they do not have to work as much or as hard. And many men will often allow them to bring in the income to be the provider, and they will pursue personal interests and refuse to take their role as supporting the family. And so today, to even insinuate that a woman was designed to nurture children and to maintain a household, it's considered male chauvinist rhetoric that has no place in our modern politically correct society. Now, the Church of God does not believe that it's wrong for a woman to have a job, to be productive and given a just wage for her work. You know, personal pursuits of this nature can be pursued once the children have grown and the needs at home are fulfilled. Now, Proverbs 31, as we had read, it shows how this virtuous woman had servants, and she bought a field, and she produced things from it, and she worked with her hands. She made quality goods that were sold to merchants. However, if pursuits of this nature causes the woman to lack in her responsibility to the children and to the household, then it can become wrong. Consider the psalmist who wrote this in Psalm 113. And in verse 4, It says the Eternal is high above all nations, His glory above the heavens. Who is like the Eternal, our God, who dwells on high? And so it talks about how great He is, and it speaks of how His wisdom is so much superior to ours, and how loving and merciful He is. And then in verse 9, as a part of His love, it says, He makes the barren woman to keep house and to be a joyful mother of children. Praise the Eternal. And so this verse, I believe, speaks of a girl who grows into womanhood. And she has no children initially. But by God's love, He designed for her to have a home, a household to take care of, and to be given children, which are a joy to this world. And there is honor, and there is pleasure, and great happiness in this role. As Proverbs 31 had stated, you know, the fruit of the work of her hands give praise to her in the gates. They praise her in the town and in the city. And this verse expresses the joy of motherhood and her admirable place in the family. However, this view does not sit well with most women today. And many of those listening to this message, and many of those here, might be balking as well. But why? Why is this? Could it be that we have also been influenced by Satan's con and into believing that a woman can rightfully fulfill the roles of mother and father? You know, we live in the age of self, which I could call selfish independence. A feminist attitude has spun out of control in this world, and there is a rampant feminization of men, but there is also a widespread masculinization of women. And so society has come to believe that a woman can adequately fulfill the role of a man as well as a woman. And many women have become quite comfortable wearing both the pants and the dress in the family. It was Helen Reddy who wrote a song in the early 70s that reached number one in the Billboard charts. And it was titled, I Am Woman. And in this song, she said the following words. She sang, I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. You can bend but never break me, 'cause it only serves to make me more determined to achieve my final goal. And I come back even stronger, not a novice any longer, 'cause you've deepened the conviction in my soul. Oh yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom born of pain. Yes, I've paid the price, but look how much I've gained. If I have to, I can do anything. I am strong. I am invincible. I am woman. Understanding the wiles of the devil and the marketing of evil that takes place in our society, we can see an obvious misrepresentation of a woman's natural role in this song. The position of a traditional wife and mother is now viewed as being lowly and degrading. And while there may be some references in this song that can be interpreted as anti-abuse, widely, Miss Reddy refers to the woman's natural role as being fraudulent, where she says, I'm not going to pretend, oppressive, unlearned, unrewarding, and even damaging. And as shocking as it may sound, these words are the thoughts of those who praise the sin of Eve. And yes, there are people who praise what Eve had done in the garden when she took of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And there are even some who worship her as a type of God. Now this dates all the way back to ancient Greece, where many of their female gods were portrayed as taking fruit from a tree that housed a serpent. and they were liberated for doing such a thing. They had become enlightened, and they were greatly rewarded for taking of this fruit. Now, these are fables, but these legends stem from a biblical truth, an account that yielded results that were far less favorable to the woman. And so this idolizing of Eve, it has silently passed down to our age in more ways than one. You know, I've read New Age poetry in the past that reinvent the biblical account to be an invigorating time for Eve, where she is now bright and she's open-minded, she's liberated, and she's tolerant, even tolerating sin. Now, most feminists would actually praise her as a trailblazer that set a path for all women to follow. Take matters into your own hands, you know, rebel, disobey, become the dominant one, but with a feminine touch. Now, God did not desire for this to be so. The adversary and those who have been persuaded by him have led countless numbers to think that the traditional husband and wife roles are outdated ideals that have no place in the family structures of today. Now, there can be no question. There's no question. There's no doubt in our minds that this attitude has affected women throughout the world. However, to some degree, it has also affected women in the church of God. And if you do not think that this is the case, I would like you to take a personal test. Even if you think that this is the case, let's take a personal test. I want all the women and even the girls out there, I want you to get a pen and a piece of paper. After you get this pen and paper, I'm going to make one simple statement. A simple statement, and I would like each woman or girl to write down a little note of how this statement makes them feel. What do you think about this statement? If you don't want to write it down, you don't have to. Make a mental note, though. You ready? Here's the statement. In a family and in society, a woman must know her place. In a family and in society, a woman must know her place. Now, I'm not going to ask you to respond right now at this time. Maybe we'll talk about it later, but how did this statement make you feel? What did you think of? Did it strike a nerve? Did it make you feel uncomfortable, upset, anxious, possibly even angry? How many women were offended in some way by these words? I think most of the women were. But why? Why were we offended by it? Why should a Christian woman be offended at the idea of understanding her place? I'm going to make another statement, and I want you to do the same thing. Again, write it down. Write it down or make a mental note. And here's the next statement. In a family and in society, a man must know his place. In a family and in society, a man must know his place. Now, how many women were offended or felt uneasy about this statement? What did you think about it? Likely nobody felt uneasy about it or uncomfortable with it. I mean, they probably said, yes, you're right, 100%, I agree. A man needs to know his place. Well, how about this? A child needs to know their place. How did that make you feel? What did you think about that? Still no offense, right? No offense, but mentioning that a woman needs to know her place are words of war in our culture today. And it even pricks those women who claim to be Christian. Why is this? Why? It is because we have been influenced by the masculinization of women. Now, we all have a role to fill, and Christians especially should understand this truth. However, accepting and maintaining our place in this modern age of independence and the idea of do as thou wilt has become difficult, and it has influenced many women in the Church of God. They have been affected by this idea of I am woman, hear me roar, I can do anything I want. Now consider that there's not a single thing wrong with any one of us knowing our place, whether it's a man, a woman, or a child. We should all know what God expects of us. You know, God designed the family, and He made each of us to all have a purpose and a function. And our roles as men and women are honorable, and they're nothing to be avoided, to be upset about, or to be uncomfortable with or ashamed of. No, not at all. Let's turn over to Mark in chapter 10. Mark in chapter 10. I want to take a few moments to discuss the very purpose of a man and a woman. Let's consider a question. You know, why did God create gender anyway? Why did He create man and woman? You know, from a statement Christ made in Matthew 22 and verse 30, and of course the understanding that the resurrected saints are going to marry Christ, you know, the church widely believes that spirit beings have no gender. Now, we can't say with 100% of surety one way or another. However, we do understand that God created man in His image. Male and female, He created them. And so making reference to Genesis in chapter 1 and verse 27, Christ says this in Mark 10, and beginning in verse 6. He said, Verse 6, but from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh, so that they are no longer two, but one flesh. And so we see here a purpose for gender. It was for us to understand the family, and so that the man and the woman could come together, two individuals as one flesh in a relationship. Shows us how a functional family is to work as we come together and work for the greater good of the one. And so procreation, of course, is a vital part of this process. And this is where a man and woman can share in the miracle of life and the joys of bringing a child into this world and raising God-fearing children. You know, ultimately, the purpose of a man and a woman in a marital relationship is for spiritual growth, so that we can mature as individuals who come to understand God and how our relationship is to be with Him. And so God is a family, and He designed our human families to reflect what He is all about and what we are ultimately to be a part of. And so in a family, we all have our place. We each have a role to play. We each have responsibilities and expectations and tasks and duties that we are expected to fulfill as a member of a family. And we learned last week how the man is to be the protector and the provider and the one who ultimately makes the final decisions. And he does this in the best interest of the family. And of course, he is not to misuse or abuse this position at all. He doesn't use it as a means to lord over the family and micromanage every little thing that is done. But instead, he is to rule in a loving and a nurturing way. And so in this relationship, the Christian woman has a vitally important role to play as well. And she is to help the man in this endeavor. And the two become one. It is not the man where the woman tries to become like him. No, they both come together and they become one. Two individuals that work together for the good of the one family unit. In this loving relationship that they are to have, the man respects his wife, doesn't he? And in this, he treats her with kindness and with admiration. And he talks to her, he counsels with her, and makes decisions that are in her best interest, doesn't he? He does not use his authority to serve himself. He does not abuse his wife or his children because he is somehow unsatisfied. He makes sacrifices for the family to ensure that their needs are met. And so the man works, doesn't he? And he goes without if need be so that they can have. And he gives compliments to his wife and to his children and praises them for their efforts. And he acts also as a type of priest in the house to ensure that the commandments of God are kept by the entire household. And in this, he must correct error when it is found. But he does so mercifully, doesn't he? Because he wants God to also show mercy to him. Let's turn all the way back to Genesis in chapter 3. Genesis 3. When defining the role of a woman in this relationship, God declared this to Eve, and this, of course, extends to all women. In Genesis 3, in verse 16, to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. And this is him chastising her, if you will, after she had eaten of the forbidden fruit. Continuing, he says, your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Now, because the woman was deceived and took it upon herself to make the infamous decision of eating the forbidden fruit, she was put under the rule of her husband. Now, you don't have to go there, but you might want to jot down 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 3 and 1 Timothy 2 and verse 14 state that the serpent deceived Eve and not Adam. And of course, we know the story that the woman brought the fruit unto the man, and he did eat also. And so in this, Adam was not guiltless. However, she made the first move to sin, and therefore God put the man over the woman. And so this role of the man, again, we must emphasize, is not to be abused. You know, this has to be clear because, again, our society has caused many women to be irritated at the thought of a man being dominant over them. And this thought might stem from the fact that there are men who have misused their authority and have abused their wives. However, this is not to be the case. But in any case, people in general do have a problem with authority. You know, we don't like someone being over us. You know, there are even ministers in the Church of God that have a clear problem with authority. And, you know, I've been in contact with people that have explained to us how their minister has instructs members to take matters into their own hands and to perform duties that were given to those who are ordained. And thus people have come to disrespect authority in the church and authority in government and even the hierarchy in the family as if it is something bad. But God is a family, and God's government is a hierarchical government, isn't it? And we see that the family is designed after the government of God. And so we have no problem hearing the words that we have dominion over the fish and over the animals. And hearing that God has dominion over us might be an easier pill for most people to swallow. However, hearing that the man has dominion over the woman is an entirely different monster for many people, isn't it? But why? Why? Why can't we accept the fact that we all have our place in the world? We all have our place in the family and in society, and then try to fulfill our duties as men and women. Have we also been influenced by the wiles of the devil that have deceived the world into thinking that the guidelines God had set for men and women are not to be followed, that we can do as we will? Many people have. Ephesians in chapter 5. You knew this was coming, of course. Ephesians 5 is another place where the role of a woman is defined. And in this chapter, Paul begins by speaking to the church as a whole, and he is informing them of the behaviors that are to be avoided, that are ungodly. And then he moves to the marital relationship of a man and a woman, and rightly so, because this relationship reflects the relationship between the church and Christ. In Ephesians 5, and beginning in verse 22, Paul wrote, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. And therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything." And so God states that the woman is to be subject to the man, just as the church is subject to Christ. And so in our human relationship, it does not mean that women are somehow inferior to men. That's not what is being said here at all, though some would like to believe that, so they can justify not submitting to their to their husbands. That's not the case. God is simply pointing out who is in charge in the family structure. And so this truth does not mean that women cannot let their concerns be known. She can offer suggestions, alternative plans, if you will, because the two become one, right? They work together for the greater good, and so they counsel together to decide what is best for everyone involved, right? Now, a loving Christian man should be able to recognize this truth and should welcome the counsel of his wife. Now, you don't have to turn there, but I think an interesting parallel comes from the words of Christ in Matthew in chapter 18. And when speaking of decisions made in the church by the church government, Christ said this. In beginning in verse 18, he said, "Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." And so he's talking about decisions made within the church that, of course, are within the constraints of his law. And if these decisions are made, he will give the stamp of approval on it. "Again, I say to you," he says, if two of you agree on earth concerning anything they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there in the midst of them." And so this is not talking about having a church service. Some people believe this is saying, as long as two or more get together, you know, it's a church service. That's not what's being spoken of here. Look at the context. It's talking about decisions made within the church government. And if two or more are gathered together in these decisions, and as long as it's within the guidelines of God's law, Christ will be in the midst of the decision. He is going to influence it, and he will give a stamp of approval upon it. And so this means that in the relationship between Christ and the church, he is going to be there. He is going to be a part of it, right? Now, understanding this, how might this principle play out and the relationship between a man and a woman in the family. If they gather together in the name of Christ, that is doing good for one another and for the good of the family, wouldn't Christ be in the midst of them? Wouldn't he be in the decision that is influencing that decision and give the stamp of approval upon it? I think he would, as long as it's within the boundaries of his law. Now, a good husband recognizes this truth and welcomes concerns from his wife, you know, because she is like his personal confidant in this regard, right? They should be able to discuss anything together and to talk about it and to work things out. However, if the husband decides to do something that the woman disagrees with, it is her duty to abide by this decision peacefully. She has to listen and abide by the man's final decision, even if she feels that it's the wrong choice. You know, because let's say it is the wrong choice. If it's the wrong move and a mistake is made, the man is going to learn a valuable lesson from it, isn't he? However, if it's the right choice and she doesn't agree, the woman's going to learn a valuable lesson, isn't she? And isn't this what it is all about? Weren't we put here on this earth so that we can make mistakes here and learn from those mistakes? We were. So that when we become glorious spirit beings, we will not make those same mistakes, right? That is the very purpose of mankind being made physical and put on this planet. And so men also need to consider something in this regard. We need to remember that women were made with a natural nurturing instinct. Women have a sensitive way about them that is pleasant, that it's hard for men to mimic this or even understand it at times. Some people call it a woman's touch. And, you know, they create environments that are comfortable, that smell good, that are pretty, and they beautify things with, you know, their doilies and their pretty little lacy things. And they're natural homemakers, aren't they? And this is something that they can excel at because it was designed in them, into the very fabric of their being. God put it there. However, women tend to act on emotion instead of principle. And so men are generally strong and brutish, and we're not as sensitive to people and to things, but we're very industrious, and we can work very hard, and we were designed that way. I mean, look at the build of men. They were designed to work hard and to be productive. However, they were also made to stay focused on the goal and to generally act upon principle instead of emotion. But men generally need women to help balance us out, don't we? Just as women need men to help balance them out. And so the point Paul was making in Ephesians 5 is that we are to be in subjection to Christ, just as wives are to be in subjection to their husbands. But many people do not understand the idea behind this instruction. And most people today see submissiveness as a bad word, something that's wrong. You know, a woman being submissive to her husband in today's societies, it's like taboo in our age in more ways than one. You know, try reading Ephesians 5:22 at a Madonna concert, and you're going to be ridiculed and mocked, and you're likely going to be physically attacked as you try to get out the door. You know, the carnal mind is enmity with God, and therefore many believe that this biblical concept of being submissive is oppressive to women. And it's because they have a wrong and a predisposed idea of what a submissive wife is truly like. You know, from a feminist perspective, they paint a picture of a Proverbs 31 woman who is silent, who's a weak person, who lacks self-confidence, and she's lorded over by an uncaring and a dictator-like husband. But that's not the case at all, is it? That is not even close to what God speaks of in the Scriptures. Why do most people feel this way? Why do they feel like a woman is not to submit to her husband? Well, it's because this secular perspective of a godly woman is inspired by the devil that hates God's design of a family, because God is family and Satan is no longer destined to be a part of that family. And he would like nothing more than to destroy this institution and to tear down the proper roles of a husband and wife. And if he can do this, the whole institution of the family begins to crumble, just as we see it happening today. You know, this world is missing a vital point, and many of us, I believe, are forgetting something critical as well. Following the verses explaining that a wife is to submit to the authority of her husband, Paul states this in Ephesians 5, and this time in verse 25. He says, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish." And so what is a man to do when he loves his wife? Well, he treats her well, doesn't he? He takes care of her. He cherishes her. He works to provide for her. He does things that make her feel good, that make her feel wanted and desired. He listens to her thoughts and concerns, and he values her opinion, and he makes sacrifices for her, just as Christ made sacrifices for the church. And so love is not bossy. Love is not abusive. Love is kind, and love is gentle, but it's firm when it comes to principle, which is doctrine. Ephesians 5, in verse 28, "So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church." For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. And so those men who might take their wives for granted, who abuse them verbally, emotionally, or possibly even physically, you know, consider, would they do this to their own bodies? Would any man in his right mind, that is, ever desire for himself to be taken advantage of, to be abused, to be emotionally hurt? No, he wouldn't. Because he loves his body, he cherishes his flesh, he wants it to be nurtured and taken care of. Well, so men are also to nourish and cherish their wives, because they no longer are two. They are one flesh, and they are to be treated as one flesh. In verse 31, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." So as a husband and wife have become one, we of course are to treat each other as if we are one. However, even though we are now one, the husband and wife still have respective roles to play in the family relationship. They cannot both be the mother, and they cannot both be the father. They work together as a team, but with different roles. And these roles reflect something, don't they? They reflect something of great significance, as Paul continued to write in verses 32 and 33. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. The mystery Paul spoke of here is profound. Hundreds of lessons can be learned by recognizing this truth. And I suggest that all of us go back at a later time, go back and read Proverbs 31, keeping this perspective in mind, and that this woman reflects how we, the church, are to be in relationship to Christ. And so we see then that Christ came to this world, right? He came here and he suffered the worst kind of torment and death for the good of the church. And by this, he taught the men that we should also make sacrifices for the wife and for the family. And so the husband is to make decisions and to work based upon love and for the good of his family. And we see then also that the woman has a part to play, doesn't she? She has a vital part to play. And she should be looked to and talked to in order to ensure that her concerns are addressed by the man. 1 Corinthians 12. There is a dominant parallel throughout the scriptures between a husband and wife and Christ and the church. Many spiritual truths can be seen in this relationship. And in this, we see that both parties have a place that is exclusive to them. But does this mean that one role is better than the other? No, it does not. There is a hierarchy, but each one is of extreme significance. Now, Paul gives an interesting and, I believe, a fitting illustration of Christ and the church and the human body. In verse 12 of 1 Corinthians in chapter 12, he wrote, "For as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body being many are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, and have all been made to drink into one Spirit. For in fact the body is not one member, but many. If the foot should say, 'Because I am not a hand, I am not of the body,' is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear should say, 'Because I am not an eye, I am not of the body,' is it therefore not of the body? Of course not. If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? And if the whole were hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set members, each one of them, in the body, just as he pleased. And if they were all one member, where would be the body? But now indeed there are many members, yet one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, 'I have no need of you,' nor again to the head, to the feet, 'I have no need of you.' No, much rather, these members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. And those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, on these we bestow greater honor, and our unpresentable parts have greater modesty. But our presentable parts have no need, but God composed the body, having given greater honor to that part which lacks it, that there should be no schism in the body, but that the members should have the same care one for another. And if one member suffers, all members suffer with it. And if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. And now you are the body of Christ, and members individually." And so we see here that Christ and the church are considered one body. But not everyone serves in the same way, do they? No, some are apostles, some are deacons, some are elders, some serve in the background. But they're all important. They're all a part of the body. We can't say one is better than the other. A hierarchy, yes, but not one being better than the other. And so it is also with a man and a woman. they come together in this relationship and they form one family, which is likened to one body, but they do not both serve in the same way, but they do still serve. And they both serve the children and they both serve one another. They do, and they work for the greater good. You know, I graduated from nursing school recently, and in this, I recognize the truth that I could not do it without my wife, that she deserves the reward just as much as I do, because without her, it would not have been possible. She needs to be recognized as a vital part of the body of the family, as all women are in every family. And so the question has arisen, what should a woman do when her man is not fulfilling his duties in the family? Should she be assertive and take matters into her own hands, or should she keep to herself and let things fall apart? Well, the answer is somewhere in between. Now, obviously, the woman should not try to play the dominant role in the family relationship. This can be problematic on several levels. For example, let's say a man is not fulfilling his duty to provide for the family, and he instead is taking it easy, lounging around, you know, not getting out and getting a job and working to provide those things that the family needs. Now, if the woman goes out and says, I'm going to go get a job, I'm going to provide for the family, if she does this and takes over his responsibility, you know, the man may very well comfortably go along with it. You know, I've seen this happen, where men just allow it to happen. They encourage it to happen. And so the woman has now actually created a viable means for her husband to relinquish his responsibility to the family. And this can be debilitating to men. And so, and he may find no real motivation now to get out and to generate sustenance. And there is another aspect of this. If we believe that God is working with us, that he is working with us women and our families, you know, taking over the man's responsibility removes a major factor in his role as being the man. You know, what then is God going to use to correct the wrong if the family needs are now being taken care of? You know, God uses circumstance and often pain and difficult times to turn us around. You know, if we don't allow sometimes these difficult times to take place, could it be that we're actually working against God? It's something to think about. Now, there may be cases. There might be cases where the woman needs to become the provider, such as in a crisis. You know, perhaps the husband is hospitalized or are unable to fulfill his duties for some reason. In these instances, a woman can be justified in doing what is necessary to make ends meet. But it must be understood that this is not how it is supposed to be, and there should be alternate plans made, if at all possible. You know, in addition, we also cannot excuse our husband's lack of manhood when he may be fully capable of providing for the family, but is simply not desiring to do so. You know, Mr. Bradick had mentioned that in AA, one of the things they teach the women of men who are the wives of men who are alcoholics is that, you know what, you're going to have to start letting him wake up on the front lawn drunk. You're going to have to stop calling in sick for him and making excuses for him, because it might be that this is what he needs to get back up on his feet and realize, I can't continue living like this. Now, instead, I would suggest for women to offer alternative plans. And, you know, plan B or plan C, etc. Now, if the husband is finding it difficult to fulfill his role as the man in the family, you know, encourage him. Give him words of encouragement. Offer solutions. Attempt to build him up by, you know, making suggestions. And if he's offended in some way by this encouragement, well, you know, you fulfilled your part of the your role, and the ball's now in his court. He has to make a choice. You know, another option can be found is something that is rudimentary in the animal kingdom. You know, before I moved out of California, we had made a trip down to San Diego SeaWorld, and this park is just a wonderful place. It's amazing to see these beautiful creations of God and these animals and their majesty in many ways, and God's reflection in these things that he has made. But it's also really neat to see what men have trained some of these animals to do. And so you can see dolphin shows where they'll leap and play with balls and toss them back and forth, and they'll jump through hoops that are on fire, and they'll swim around in circles side by side, jumping one over another, and you know, people being able to ride two of them like they're riding skis in the water. It is simply amazing. And then you can, you know, these some of these killer whales they have, these huge brute beasts that have been trained to do such intricate tricks that can leap up dozens of feet into the air and take a tiny fish out of the mouth of a person. It is just amazing what these animals can do. You know, Mr. Bradick had mentioned in the past that he had visited this place as well, and he was so moved by what these animals did that he had to talk to a trainer to see, you know, how do you get these animals to do these tricks? It's amazing. How do you do this? The answer was this. You reward anything that comes close. When a trainer wants to get an animal to perform in an amazing way, you begin by rewarding anything that comes close. And so if you want them to jump so high, you know, you get them to jump a little bit and you give them a fish, even if it's just a little bit out of the water. And then as you do it more often, you don't give them the fish until they jump a little higher and then a little higher. Pretty soon they're jumping 20 feet up in the air over a bar. This is how it works. This is how you train animals, and they can learn because they are being rewarded for their efforts. Now, interestingly, this method works very well for people as well. You know, when a child makes a move towards a desired behavior, we praise them for it, don't we? And this works to motivate them to step it up a notch, to take it a step further, because it feels good. Everybody likes to be praised. Everybody likes a reward, right? Well, this works very well with men also, doesn't it? Yes. When they make a move towards being a man, tell him how much you respect him. You know, show him love. Tell him how much you appreciate his efforts. Encourage the behavior, you know, build confidence in the man. And you're going to find that you will motivate him to taking further actions. Even baby steps need encouragement. And if the man is not motivated, you know, the chances of him taking further steps are greatly reduced. But a woman who builds her man in this way is going to find that they will become more protective and responsible towards the family. On the other hand, if a man is ridiculed and put down in what might be unsuccessful efforts, we could actually extinguish the chance that he is going to try again, because he's going to have a fear of further derision and failure. Let's turn over to 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy in chapter 5. A question now arises. What if a man refuses to step up? What if the woman has tried to encourage him? What if she has made efforts to offer alternative plans, and he still refuses to be a man? Should she let things fall apart? Go to pot, if you will. Are you going to hate me for this one? But the answer is no, but yes. Now first, If the husband truly loves his wife, he is going to listen to her. And offering solutions and showing him encouragement, this should render success the vast majority of the time. And this is, in fact, taking action. It's not letting things fall apart. It's taking action, but without usurping his authority. Now, when the scriptures state for a woman to keep silent, it's not referring to keeping her mouth shut while the house burns down. It doesn't mean that the man can come into the house and cut a large hole in the middle of the living room floor and she should just stand by and watch it and not say a single word. That is not what is meant at all. When it speaks of a woman keeping silent, it's speaking about spiritual leadership, and the man is to act as a type of priest in the household. And so instead, a Christian woman should and can offer counsel to her husband regarding the good of the family. And if he loves her, and if he truly wants to do what's right, he is going to hear it, and he will act. However, if he continually refuses to listen and chooses instead to deny his duties, then she should let it go to pot. Now, this might sound harsh, especially if there is children involved, but there is a higher purpose for this. It may very well be that this is the only way that he is going to learn. And it might be that this is, in fact, what God will use to force him to overcome and to be a man. As was asked in the opening prayer by Mr. Fox, you know, he had mentioned God, who has begun a good work in us, will accomplish it. Well, how is he going to accomplish it? You know, God uses circumstances and situations to accomplish his good work in us. He allows us to suffer harm sometimes so that we can learn, oh, I'm going the wrong way. I'm not fulfilling my duties here as a man or as a woman. And so what if God intends to use failure as a means to motivate the man to stand up and to take his rightful place? You know, sadly, some have to hit rock bottom before they're going to make a move. And lamentably, they often affect loved ones in this bottoming out. 1 Timothy 5, in verse 8, states this: "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel or an unbeliever." These are strong words from the Apostle Paul that might make some men gulp. As well it should. You know, providing for our own is of the utmost importance, and God expects us to do this. And in denying this responsibility given to us men is likened to going against God. And so providing for our families includes, you know, putting food on the table. It includes clothing our wives and our children. But there's a lot more to it than that, isn't there? It also means to provide a warm and a nurturing environment, not a house that is hostile and filled with strife, but a home that is instead a shelter for the storms of life, and shelter from the literal storms outside, right? A place where the love of God can be seen because it is in fact present in the home. Ephesians in chapter 4. Now there may be some extreme examples out there that might need further counsel. And some might try to debate these principles that I am speaking of today because of a rare situation or some kind of a freak conflict. Now, it must be understood, that acute circumstances are not the norm. We cannot try to disregard what's being said today because of some freak situation. You know, I would liken that to those people that are pro-choice who argue that abortion is okay because they use the example of, what are you going to do when that 12-year-old girl is brutally raped by some horrible man and she's pregnant? Are you going to make her have that child as a constant reminder of one of the most horrible things that happened in her life? Or is she going to be allowed to have an abortion? And then they try to say that abortion across the board should be legal because of a one in a million situation. We can't do this. We can't do this. Don't try to discount what's being said today by bringing up a circumstance that might need special attention. You know, don't try to excuse ourselves away by saying that, you know, I'm special. My situation's different. Now, the purpose of this message is to make us further aware of how the river of society is flowing downstream and headed towards the fall. And we cannot move along with it. We have to grab on to that rock of truth and stand on that rock and let the water flow by down the waterfall. A man and a woman should be tied to the rock of Christ. And in this, they are to work together for the good of the children and for the good of each other. And if they will do this, it will lead to a successful and to a joyful marriage. Not that there's going to be an absence of hard times, but the two will be able to come together and work through these difficult times as one. Ephesians 4, and in verse 15, speaking the truth in love, that we may grow up in all things into Him who is the head, that is Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effect of working, by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. 1 Timothy 2. I should have told you to hold your place there. 1 Timothy 2. The message today is obviously directed toward the woman in a marital relationship. However, it does apply to single women as well. You know, they might not have a husband and children, but their place in the marital relationship should be kept in mind, because there are eternal principles in this regard. And in today's independent, self-sustaining society, a single woman may be led to believe that she doesn't want a man, she doesn't need a man. And the modern woman, she might want companionship and love, but she doesn't want the dominance. And so she might find herself unable to allow a man to take his rightful place at her side. Don't be fooled by this. Don't be fooled by the deceptions of the feminization of men and the masculinization of women. This is not how God intends for it to be. A Christian woman has a honorable and glorious place in marriage, in family, and in society. She should be admired in this role and not deemed as less important. Without her, men become something that God did not intend. Again, describing the Christian woman in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and in verse 9, Paul wrote, "In like manner also, let the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold pearls or costly clothing, but that which is proper for women, professing godliness with good works. Let a woman learn in silence, with all submission. And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have the authority over a man, but to be in silence. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell into transgression. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control." as we saw in Proverbs 31. Women can have a job, and they can be a productive part of society. However, their family is the first priority and must be served. If this is maintained, they can have pursuits that they enjoy. However, women are not to come to a point where they start to walk, talk, dress, and look like men. Women are to know their place, just as Christian men are also to know their place, just as children in our families are to know their place. And we are all to work together in love, in faith, in holiness, and with self-control. And so let's take your places, everyone. Ready? Action.